numbers. We have received the support back, and this is one of those deals that we've been struggling with for quite some time. And I also want to present this opportunity to all of the members to interact with the presentation in form of questions, of clarity, and comments. As you know, the process is going to unfold within the committee itself in terms of the arrangements. So this report will definitely enhance our participation in the process as we move on. Any comments or straightforward? Mazamini, followed by Honorable Goranov, Honorable Ross, Honorable Harris, Honorable Vandoy, in that order, and Honorable Chawalala.
Thank you, Chair, and I would like to take this opportunity to apologize for coming late. Thank you to the DDG and his team. Indeed, it is a very complex complex amendments that we have gone through. If you can go to your slide number 12, DDG. Just to remind, because I can't remember it quite well on the credit rating, who the supervisor, what powers the supervisor does he have in other ways? I remember the registrar, I remember they say the supervisor will then approve the transfer of oil or part of the insurance businesses. If you can just remind me on that one. Slide number 14. On site visit powers. On the new additional proposal by the department, where you are saying the registrar, the first proposal you are saying additional safeguard to constrain the registrar from intruding. And then just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think it's bullet number 4, they're saying the registrar right of access. Now on top we are saying it's intruding, and below the edge we are saying it's got the right. Now if anybody takes us to court, will us be able to defend this law effectively? If it is going to be written like that, the registrar from intruding, then the registrar's right to access to documents, and then following it, you're saying the greater clarity. What exactly are we saying? How do we measure? How do we defend the greater clarity at the court of law, greater clarity as to when the registrar may remove the documents? And then, Chair, on slide number 18, clause number 9, trustees have a fiduciary duty. If I can just get a clarity, if these fiduciary duties are made clearer somewhere in the regulation, or they are going to be made clearer in there, we don't have to ask them that are they and what are they. If you go to page 9 of the Act itself, as I read the amendments, Janine has indicated that clause number 37 has been removed, and we are to look at clause number 42, which I don't have a problem with it, Chair. But I think to have a consistency, if we have removed clause number 37, I think it has to indicate that it has been like this, now it has been rejected or removed, then and you refer, because if you look at it, it's clause no longer there, and nobody is saying anything about it. Now, just to have the point, because we have done with other clauses where we have actually said it has been rejected and replaced by the following information. And the last one, Chair, it's statutory management on page 33 of the Act. The register made by agreement with the financial institution. Is it? I need clarity there. So the register needs to get an agreement first with the financial institution to carry those to intervene. What exactly are we saying? Or are we referring to the financial institution? Exactly what are we saying there? It's a bit confusing. And if it's confusing to me, we're supposed to really debate the act and say it's an effective act and not be challenged in the court, then I just need the clarity. That's all. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. I think we've made some progress. I just want to comment on three matters. The first one is on slide page 4, whole issue about bona fide but not grossly negligent. I really would like to have a definition of what you think is grossly negligent or what is negligence. You know, without a definition, it's going to be very difficult to support this one. If you're bona fide, you're bona fide. You've proven that to the court, you'll win. But, you know, now you're bona fide and you're 49% negligent and you'll get away with it. I'm very uncomfortable with that one. On slide number 10, with regard to the provisions of powers to the regulator, I've made a note in when you were in front of us on the 24th of April to say that the regulated powers are open-ended and it can even change, give powers to override the minister. Have you taken that out? I just want to be more specific. It is difficult for me to see whether you've taken that out and have you amended a little bit and make it a little bit more comfortable towards powers to the regulator. And then thirdly, on slide 12, I think I want to support this, that you streamline the process. It will be cheaper, less red tape, that you don't go to court. But my question, will it be eventually fair? Will it be a fair process? And if those who are involved, if they're not happy, can they eventually go to court? Thank you.
On the weekend, I just had a look at a documentary with regards to the subprime crisis in the USA, and I was quite appalled by the lack of regulation that existed in South Africa. And I think we need to find this solution in South Africa, and I think we were very fortunate that we had those regulations in place, especially if you see the poverty that was created, and also the role that the credit rating agencies played or did not play correctly. It's quite an interesting documentary. Documentary. But, Chair, on the other side of the coin, I don't think my personal view is, you know, to give regulators a sort of carte blanche would also be problematic, and I think we have to find the right balance in this regard. For me, I can add my voice to Honourable Quernoff with regards to the exercise in good faith. I think it's a bit vague, and really like this perhaps, and he only has taken his legal opinion a bit further with regards to grocery negligence, if we can have more details with that. With regard to accountability from the registrar, that would be helpful. On the second key issue, number two, the policy protection rules, certainly we need to protect the consumers. That should be point number one. But I think we, to a certain extent, I think we need to table this down, that we don't have complete interference in terms of the regulations that we do. I have a concern from the industry that say that it could lead to a total demise in the insurance industry. The economic impact of this amendment may be wholly disastrous. Competitive advantage in this insurance industry results about the wording of the policy. My question is, what is the capacity of the financial services board to intervene and correct the wording of the industry? Are we adequately up to the task to correct every insurer out there, do we have the capacity to look at every insurance policy, so to speak, and do we have this capacity? And then with regard to point number three, key issue number three, the delegation of subordinate legislative powers to Parliament, powers to subordinate powers, I would like to say, and I'm quite concerned that we do away with the advisory committees, that we do away with powers, completely scattered. Brought also in the past a lot of expertise to the process, and is there not a way that we can restore that balance? And then the necessity of deleting powers to make subordinate legislation without certain parameters. Certainly, I would like to make the following comment to that, that I believe parliamentary scrutiny is still necessary, and that we don't move away from it, and that we don't put all the powers within the register. And that we still move it towards the parliamentary process where we can have an oversight role in terms of this. And this is just back to the documentary when I saw, I thought this was important, that we keep the oversight from parliament intact. We registrars do not comply to the obligations of the ship. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a huge amount to process. we did get a copy of the, I thought it was called the B bill, which is usually referring to the A bill. Either way, we did get a copy of that last week, but we didn't get the annexes, which as usual are very helpful. So we got those today for the first time. I didn't see those before. And we certainly didn't get the slides. So the bill of A or the B bill that we received is quite difficult to make sense of out of context. But now you have explained it. I still need a lot of time to process what's changed and what hasn't. I don't know if the DDG has been deliberately provocative by referencing this word draconian again and specifying that it's in the slides because it was in the slides before. The last time I checked, PowerPoint slides didn't have any significant status. And I think it would be relatively easy for Treasury to change their adjective if they decided that perhaps draconian intrusiveness was not necessarily the thrust they were trying to take. I think, in fact, these words are still there and still in caps, still bold. So Treasury's stance is still one of prioritizing draconian powers over appropriate powers, prioritizing intervention over the power of competition, and prioritizing significant powers for the FSB over perhaps the civil liberties of citizens of this country. That's my general philosophical position since the beginning, and I'm afraid as long as the introductory slides keep making the point about draconian intrusion, I think we're actually going too far. Of course, by setting out an initial set of proposals that do go too far and then filing on some of the roughest edges, you can perhaps try and claim victories in terms of big concessions. But I want to go through the proposals and check them. But overall, on the big three issues, which I think were reliability, the protection of policyholders, and the process of consultation, there have been some concessions on margins. But for me, the question of whether the broad thrust of this legislation strikes the appropriate balance between draconian powers and appropriate powers is remains unanswered. I will take a look at this in the next few days and come back with a position. But on those three major questions, the liability clause, there's essentially no concession here. Now, on slide 8, Treasury talks about FSB being able to exercise powers in good faith. But if Honourable Cornock is looking for a definition of gross negligence, I understand that it means serious carelessness. So I'm not sure if exercising powers in good faith is compatible with the concept of serious carelessness. I would argue that it isn't. But just to get some specific answers from Treasury, in your view, does removing the clause not gross negligence exempt the FSB from acts of gross negligence? And if that is the case, why is that necessary? It's still not, I've not yet been convinced of why that's necessary. And then secondly, if you've admitted that by delegating, you're delegating greater powers to the registrar to increase the accountability of the registrar, how does exempting them from gross negligence help to increase accountability? This question, Chair, still is the biggest one, I think, in the bill, and it still needs to be answered. On the protection of policyholders, Momo prefaced his responses talking about 2008 and the subprime crisis, and I know the comments of my colleagues on that crisis. I think everybody on both sides of the House agrees that what happened in 2008 was failure of regulation, and it's important to fix regulation so that it doesn't happen again. But we can't use a subprime crisis in the US, which was focused or at least triggered entirely by mortgage financing, to justify changing insurance laws. They're a world apart. It's simply not acceptable to say, because of 2008, we need to have draconian interventions in the insurance market. I think we need appropriate interventions in the insurance market, and I would argue for that any day of the week. But certainly we can't use 2008 to justify going too far. Now, in this regard, Chair, there have been a couple of concessions. In subsection D and E, they've now been made general, not specific, which is something that we welcome. The deletion of 5 and 6 we agree with. But I still am not convinced that we shouldn't replace registrar of the minister throughout the text. I think, given that we've constructed this a robust parliamentary oversight, we have almost two decades of experience in tabling new laws and regulations, allowing this parliament to do oversight over these kinds of interventions. To not simply take that away from us by giving these powers to the registrar and sidestepping the minister, I think is the wrong step to take. And then on the last issue, which is the process of consultation, now we have direction on a new code of conduct. I would still be, I mean, that is a step in the right direction, but would it be possible to see a draft code of conduct during the legislative process? Because we really need to reassure ourselves that this process, or that taking this approach, will be superior over the advisory boards that my colleagues really raised questions about. So we've gone some way in the right direction, but I think we need a draft would perhaps put our minds at ease. Then, Chair, there's a whole host of issues beyond those three. I haven't had a chance to get my head around them, but I will in the coming weeks.
Van Rooyen, I just hope that you are not in, according to your designated positions in terms of the institutions where you come from.
Sorry, thank you very much, Chair. Let me start by welcoming the noble effort by the team. I mean, to give response to all the submissions made by others and stakeholders. I think this will go a long way in terms of giving effective relation of the participatory model of our system. And this is highly appreciated. Sure. But there are two issues. I think the first one was frequently covered by both Honorable Ross and Honorable Ferris, the issue of advisory forum versus code of conduct consultation. I didn't hear that coming out of their response. And the second one is on the call by some of the stakeholders to delay the implementation of medical interim regulations. I think there was that submission. Could we please get the response? And ask the Chair. On the clause 162, the one that deals with the register giving guidelines that prescribe on the Q Register Act. I'm not sure to what extent will this provision provide for the register to deal with one of the perennial problems around curatorship, which is a prolonged curatorship on certain cases, but also the area of managing of finances of institutions that are under curatorship. I'm not sure if this the provision will accord the register such powers. I mean, we got terrible experience of the recent cases where, there is an outcry generally around prolonged curatorship, but also management of institutions' finances by some of the curators. So I'm not sure if this clause 162 will ensure that the register is empowered adequately to deal with this particular, with the site and the problems. Thank you.
Thanks, Joseph. Let me start by welcoming the presentation, but also to comment. I think really the team has done quite a number of work, considering that it's quite a big legislation that we're dealing with, and there's a lot of issues to consider. So I really feel that they've tried to cover a lot of issues. On slide 8, around the bona fide but not gross negligence. I just want to find out from yourself that would it really be a trace mesh if we were to say that if we were to delete the grossly negligent. I think the point is made. The court of law defines bona fide and that's it. So that we don't confuse with the gross negligent whether is it, intentional, if not intentional, or not if it's something. That's something that it needs to be proven, in court of law when you say that you found it guilty, this is what you have to plead for. So you are high performance, 1, 2, 3, and so forth. So it's a long discussion that. So I really want to find out if we were to put a full stop on the issue to say that it's going to be different from the SSP 8 and that. On slide 11, around, I think, question three. When you speak about the register to prohibit insurer from carrying on insurance business without securing the prior approval to the minister, so I want to find out around that, is it really feasible that the insurance would have to go to the minister to get approval? Will it really be feasible to do that? And also, is it contradictory to what we're saying consistently around the register, the powers that they need to be doing? I can imagine the number of work that the minister would have to do just to look into insurance and give them approval. So I feel that probably it's a process, but just to get a thought around that. But also issue of the time frame, therefore, it might also, you know, step a little bit of insurance work. On the slide 15, you know, lesson one, you speak about robust process of consultation. So that's a big word. It's about robustness of the consultation. But if we say that there's a code of consultation that National Treasury, that it is the clause 50 that has been amended, that obliges OCC to prescribe the code and standards of consultation. So I want to find out around the issue of the types of consultation principles and the codes that must be addressed. So you are saying that it is there already. So I really don't see the need for us to be able to labor on the issue around the code and the standards that we're talking about. So I just wanted to lay away with the, on the process, the issue of the draft code. Because, you know, the last bulletin, they address co-sitting of some the key principles provided to give a sense of what the final code. So I want to find out, would they be final code if already a code is there, it's transcribed. So I feel that something for you to just work on rather than delivering on the issue to say you need to have a final code. Is there anything that we need to be thinking about around principles? So it's the point I wanted to make. On the last slide, on the conclusion, the 26th, the last bulletin speak about the bill will ensure consistency with the transition period around the issue of clean picks. And Fred mentioned that the sector legislation will still apply over the next 5 years until replaced by the new order of legislation. I want to find out when we say that it will still apply for the next 5 years because we're working on and where the clean picks are at. So when we say that until the new legislation, we're talking about a period of 5 years. So
it's
just
elaborating that. Thank you. Thank you, Momo. I just wanted to say to your team, we've got ranks there because the questions are so many and heavy. You know, when we read about the budget on catering for Parliament, good things for members only, they don't include themselves. So we want the perception to be defended by yourselves. So we must thank you.
Over to kind invitation to partake in the drinks. I've already taken advantage of that. I think, let me just start with the broad themes and then we'll respond to, I think, the specific issues. And, you know, it's correct that in the world today, we're saying what's the appropriate balance between regulation and competition and so on. Market operation. You know, I put the word draconian yesterday just to remind us of what was said before, okay, in our discussion. But let me assure the entrepreneurs, the word intrusiveness doesn't come from us, it comes from the IMF. Okay. And that's why I think if you look at some of the approaches taken, you are going to get those who believe in free markets and who believe that nothing happened in 2008 and they slept through that. Some of them are even, frankly, have done consultancy work for the industry. So that members would be lobbied, wouldn't surprise me. And often you get lobbied by people who are advocates for the industry. They don't even work in the industry, they do work for it. So it's like, you know, you've got to be more Catholic than a Pope, in this instance, to be a bit. Very strong category. And I think that, you know, it doesn't help to say that the world hasn't moved to be more inclusive. It has. Those are beginning to be incorporated into the standards. And if you look at the US, you look at the UK, you'll see that some of the changes made I mean, a lot of these provisions have been dictating to the industry, directing them how to do things, has become the approach of the regulators. So while we don't have to dwell on the word draconian, it is intrusive. And I'll be very happy to share the papers from the IMF and others that refer to these. Indeed, many of the international forums we go to, it is almost like there's a war going on. The world is fed up with the excesses in the financial sector. And perhaps the world is going a lot in one direction. But that is the way the world, most of your major economies that we deal with, is the direction in which we're moving. You know, it's like the legislation on money laundering. A lot of people, when it was introduced, said it was draconian. It's become standard today. And in fact, if you don't, even if we didn't have those laws, if we weren't to enforce it, many of our institutions would enforce it themselves because they still want to deal with the US, the UK, etc. If these standards are not adhered to, and a lot of what we have are the international standards. And that's why we said these are standards. If we want to operate in that space, that's the game we need to play. Now, part of it also does hit at your political executives. So often the issue is in giving the regulator that power. Firstly, the regulator is powerful over the regulator. But the regulator is also then meant to be operationally independent. If you go back to the financial safety document, safer financial sector document, the so-called red book, the big issue of operational independence is critical. So when it comes to insurance, when it comes to taking action, they generally need to act without asking for political approval. If we want political approval, if you want the minister to do it, firstly, in many instances, we won't comply with the international standards. If you go to the FSEC, when it comes to, with regard to insurance, the fact that the registrar in that instance had to consult the minister has been flagged as an issue to deal with. So a lot of this is not taking the power away, but it is trying to say there's a notion of operational independence, and they need to act, obviously, and have those powers. Obviously, they still need to be accountable, and we are a democracy, and it's very important that we look at how they're accountable. And in that respect, you need to check with us as a national treasury whether we are holding the regulators accountable, in the first instance, to the minister, and in the second instance, to Parliament. I think you'd be aware, if you look at your colleagues in the UK, their portfolio committee of finance has summoned people up. If you look at the UK, the regulators come and they sit there and they have tough questions. We would welcome, certainly as a treasury, that you get people to account. And I think that, and we are focusing that on post, there must be post accountability, whether it's the Fidentia, whether it's whatever, that people have to come, once the processes are complete, that Parliament must, I think, be more vigorous and look at how it can hold the regulators to account. So that is the other side. And obviously, if there are abuses that take place, then we must look at mechanisms like commissions and so on, or ex-judges that go into these matters. So the regulators certainly have a lot of responsibility placed on their heads. They have to exercise it in good faith, and to the extent that there are mistakes, because even if they, if there's no legal liability on the regulator, and that's quite important, that doesn't mean they don't make mistakes or have acted in a way that sometimes really irresponsible, maybe in good faith, but irresponsible. That's when your post accountability really needs to come into effect. Yeah, I won't deal, and I'm going to ask the lawyers to deal with the issue of liability and the changes there and so on. And in fact, we do have, I know Advocate Jenkins was supposed to come up with an opinion on that. We also have an opinion, it's not a formal opinion yet, we want to actually bring that through so that you have a full legal opinion on that. And there's some assurance, I think, in just the way the any regulator will act. But as I said, that issue aside, the issue of accountability still goes. I think I've dealt with the issue of the powers of the minister and we deal with the specifics as questions have been asked. But there is this framework, and some of it is already there in the Banks Act. And often when a registrar acts, if you close down an insurance company or a bank and you acted badly, that bank can still take you to court. So the processes that we have, that if it was agreement with the company, you can not go to court. Obviously, with this agreement, everybody still has a right, even in the Banks Act, in terms of my interpretation, the CEO can go to court. The fact that it's a moot point, you know, with regard to a bank, that anybody, if a registrar says that you're in a bad state, people will rush to the exit already, so you might win legally, but the registrar has enormous powers, and that brings it to more the issue of accountability. But everyone does have the right to still go to court. But the point is, in the financial sector, when it comes to resolution, a lot of work internationally has been done on the resolution of banks when they are in trouble without going through the court process. But the court process is always there as an option. It's just that it's a good point. There'll be no money left by the time you use the court process. I think with regard to issues like changing the rules, nobody is saying because of subprime, we're now trying to deal with insurance. But remember, one week after the subprime, we had an insurance company that had to bail out AIG. If you look at what these measures, the market conduct regulation, the UK has established the financial conduct authority. And a lot of these provisions are, how does the market conduct itself? So in the banking space, yes, it sold subprime loans. Okay. In insurance, there's issues of what's their conduct. And in our situation, we're looking at issues of transparency and so on. Those reforms are all going together. They've been part of the problem that there wasn't transparency, that a market conduct problem like subprime caused the financial crisis. I'll give an example in our own instance. We've talked to the insurance industry recently. If you look at your car insurance products, and if you look at many of the people from the labor review project, actually went to go and visit the short-term ombud, okay? Frankly, my view, trying to harass the ombud when he acted against a company or when he made a call on a particular product. We called the insurance guys because there was a recent case with our insurance where the judge had ruled that you have to literally report every... Well, the interpretation was on the judge's ruling that the SIA representative went on radio and we can circulate the comments saying that you have to report every scratch and dent in your car, otherwise not covered. We immediately called the entire industry up. In fact, our insurance dissociated itself from the comments of the SIA person. And the industry has now issued and promised that they will issue a code of conduct so that your car values will be automatically reduced every year. It's a depreciating asset. Those are the types of norms that you want to deal with. Otherwise, if you don't want that, you can't have it both ways. If you think that there should be no regulation, it should be a free market, then we have what we have currently. You're going to have people who are not clever enough to go and say to the company every year, my car value is down. It's actually less than last year. Can you reduce the premium compared to what it would be if you kept the value up? Well, you can have those practices. Those practices today have become unacceptable. So market conduct here refers not just to consumer protection, but to how you conduct your business. Are you fair to the customer? The Treat Customers Fairly initiative. The financial sector, not just here. You can go to the UK. You can go to Australia. There are strong authorities which take up companies. In the UK, there was the PPI thing, which is not this. But some of the banks were fined recently for some sort of mortgage protection insurance that was sold. So I think trying to say there's no problem or that we've been too intrusive flies against the hiking trends that you see in other countries. And unless somebody can get up here and say our insurance industry practices, you know, there's no problem. And in fact, the industry will be destroyed if you regulate them. I think that's absolute nonsense. And again, I don't think the industry will share that view if you speak to SIAM. But certainly the guys who work as consultants for the industry and who need a job would say that. The industry said to us, some of these lawyers running around making these comments, in fact, embarrassing us. So I think that's the perspective we have. We're not taking into advance the subprime problem. We're saying there is a shift on market conduct, and that's the perspective we need to have. And yes, there is a more interventionist approach, and it's not a South Africa-specific issue. It's happening in the US. It's happening in the UK. It's happening in the EU. The provisions there are intrusive. And if you don't want me to use words like odious, but if you have a look, pretty much it's close to it in some of these countries. I think as far as the specific issues, let's just maybe deal with the liability issue. And if you can just explain that, we will then come with the two opinions. But I think that's a very crucial point that we need to deal with. I just want to make one point before she comes in. I think that we certainly have circulated the draft principles for consultation. It is there in your back. And certainly, on gross, I think that when we took a moment, the problem is we've heard the other side. There are so many advisory committees, I think we counted 14, okay, that it actually doesn't make any sense. We want to roll this up, and also it's so statutory that it kills the idea because it says X is on it, Y is on it. When you have different issues, we'd rather go to the industry and say, who would you like to nominate for this particular issue? Now, we want to be held accountable for consulting on all these issues. Because if we don't, it's a problem. But we're just saying that the current way is almost actually killed the consultation process. So it's about how best we consult with the industry. And certainly the legislation will deal with it. So perhaps let's just start with the liability issue, and then we'll deal with some of the specific issues if we can just cover those.
Thank you very much. I think it might just be helpful in light of the questions raised just to try to, as clearly as possible, explain what the implications of the amendment would be, how it would, in fact, operate in practice, the proposed amendment to Section 23. So the amendment to Section 23 would be that in a particular court case where that is brought against the FSB or an officer or an appointee of the FSB, the FSB would have to establish that the power that it was acting in terms of a power, in terms of one of its statutes, that it is responsible to implement, and that that power was exercised properly and in good faith. And if that was established, then the court would have to consider and decide whether the exercise of that power had been done with due care and also taking reasonable precautions to avoid or minimize injury to others. So that is as clear as possible a description of the analysis that would happen in the court in implementing this clause. And so if the court concluded that the power was exercised in good faith and it had been exercised with due care, taking reasonable precautions, then the court would conclude that the exercise of the power had been lawful and the FSB or the official concerned would not be held to be liable by the court. If it was found that the power was exercised in bad faith or it was exercised without taking due care and reasonable precautions to minimize injury, then the court would determine that the power was not properly exercised and the FSB or the official concerned would be held to be liable in that case. So that's as clearly as possible, I think, to try to describe the analysis. And just to touch upon the aspect of the importance of the amendment is that if the wording "but not grossly negligent" is retained, it creates issues in a particular court cases about where you have have established negligence or gross negligence, and that can be a very difficult and unclear determination to make. And so that can, there can be a lot of lengthy litigation and considerations that happen in courts over that particular issue. And it is also very important to note that regulators such as the Financial Services Board, they are dealing quite often with very contentious matters that are subject to some dispute and contestation. And so if there is not some degree of protection in the exercise of those powers, the Constitutional Court has recognized in the Steenkamp case that regulators do need some appropriate protection to exercise their regulatory powers in these very contested arenas. Otherwise, their ability to appropriately act as regulators is not properly protected and recognized. So it is recognized that regulators in the areas that they are having to operate, their functions require some degree of protection from liability. And that is why in a number of the pieces of legislation that have been referred to, such as by earlier in the presentation, it has been the wording that is applied for liability refers to the exercise of bona fide power, but it does not refer to negligence in the provision. Thank you.
Move on. I think there were a whole host of questions. I don't know if there's any issue. I don't know if anyone wants to add on the liability issue. Of course, okay. Let's move on. I think there were a whole host of questions.
Sorry to interrupt. I just, perhaps it might be helpful, given that answer, if we got a specific example of a case where this might apply, where...
I think in the text that's been given, the example of the joint municipal pension fund was given, where the trustees of that fund decided on a particular, using a particular vehicle for investment, and that investment went sour, and that they wanted to sue the registrar for the action that they took. Now the issue was there a legal duty affront for the registrar to have acted in order to be held liable? That was absent because possibly of this cross negligence and so on, because they were saying, if you are a regulator, we know what we have done as trustees, but you should have stopped us. Now there is no legal duty that binds the registrar from doing that. So we are in this, and we say, if that matter, if the registrar had the powers to stop that kind of decision from trustees, which ties down precisely with Section 7, Capital D of the Pension Funds Act, so the duty was absent. But if the duty was present and the registrar neglected to take decisions to stop the trustees from doing that, because of the size of the damage that was done, that would qualify as possibly gross and malafides would come. But it didn't. So this is just about clarifying to say, what's the malafides? If there wasn't malafides, then there can't be any liabilities. So the discussion is elaborate in the document there.
Just to add, we will provide you a formal legal opinion. What we got was too informal, so we've asked for it just to be formalized, okay? And I think you had asked Edward Jenkins' chair for an opinion as well. So we will then have the two opinions, I think, on that point. I think this is a key issue, and I think, you know, members, I think, obviously, I think it's absolutely important that we are all satisfied that the way we move is the right one based on those legal opinions. See, I think, let me just deal with, ask Dewey to come in. There was a whole host of questions on such inspections, of regulatorships, which, before he comes in, let me say what we're not trying to do. I think that in our legal system, when there's a problem, a lot of people make money. The legal counsel makes a lot of money. The curators make a lot of money. Liquidators make a lot of money. Somewhere, you know, we think in our judicial system, this thing needs to be taken, looked at. And the perverse incentives that apply, like, for example, that you stretch these things out as far as possible. There's all kinds of contingency arrangements. We think a lot of those practices are very problematic. Okay? But it's already there. People often focus on how much money, say, curators are making. Okay? But look at the entire chain and who's making a lot of money and what the incentives are. As an economist, the incentives, I can tell you, are perverse. And that's why you'll find that in the new cases, amounts are kept, etc. But we definitely need better guidelines. So do it.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'm going to link the curators.
Can I just say, with regard to the curators, there's two types. There's one, some that get appointment through a court process, and some, like under the Banks Act, and in this case with insurance, will be appointed without going through banks. Without going through the courts where there's agreement with the company. In which case, you do have greater ability, I think, to protect amounts and get hold someone to terms.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to link the question from Metlami about the statutory management approach and the creditorships. You ask us, why do we say the registrar may enter into an agreement? Why the word may? That word was used primarily to indicate that the curatorship remains the preferred route. However, with the experience that we've had over the number of years and the comments that have come from both industry, this committee and everybody, we had to apply our minds to say, how do we try and start to address this issue of curatorship? So we said, and we have two examples of statutory management even before this amendment. And then this was done through the first one was done, both were done through a court decision. The statutory management will happen where no assets have been illegally taken out of the entity. It will just purely be based on management not doing what it's supposed to do in terms of compliance, point one. Point two, it will also happen, and this is going to come out more strongly in the 2P space, where we would be encouraging entities to do what is happening already in other countries like Australia, what we would call in-breach reporting. In other words, the leadership of an institution would look at itself and say, you know what, we are in breach of that provision that we are failing, but we need assistance. On their own, they will come forward to the registrar and say, we are falling short here. Then it is in those two instances where we will try and say, let's reach an agreement as to how we address all these things that are there. But critically is that agreement, because the two parties will come together, that agreement will have to be made a court order. So you first reach an agreement, court order, you know, it's that voluntary, so that it becomes binding to the parties of the agreement. Why? Because in this statutory management, one is going to have to appoint, the registrar is going to have to appoint somebody independent to join the management of that entity. Now, if I put you in there and I don't give you powers that you require to assist to turn that institution around, you're going to be voted out. So there will be mechanisms that say, in this agreement, this is what we plan to do. But if assets have been removed out of the entity, you're still going to have to resort to curatorship. Now, I don't believe that there's anybody who's against curatorship per se. The problem around curatorship has been stated today and before. It's the length that curatorship takes and the issue of the money around curatorship. And Mohamed just said we need to look at that. If already at FSB worked on a policy, and that policy is in place, but of course, like all other policies and legislation, you always guard against accusations of retrospectivity. So that policy is already in place. It says curators cannot use their own law firms when appointed as curators, or auditors, they cannot use their own auditing firms once they are appointed as curators. That policy is in place. The main issues, we are applying our minds to as to how this money issue can be addressed. And we're looking at, we have a plan, but we're looking as to whether legislation allows us to do that or not. Because we haven't reached a conclusion yet. If we discover that legislation doesn't allow us to do it, clearly we'll have to come and say this is what we need to do. But we believe that we can already do it with the legislation that we have in place. And that may be something like saying every time you put an entity under curatorship, we're thinking about the possibility of making sure that the money part of the curatorship is actually managed in-house at the FSB, so that you create a special account. Any recoveries would come in there, any payments, deposits and all that are managed from inside. And the advantage with that system would be those accounts will also be subjected to the Auditor General to get them. So we are looking at that. We haven't arrived at the conclusion, but it's one aspect that we want to address all these issues of monies around curatorships. Mohamed spoke about consultation. With regard to advisory committees, honorable member, if it may sound like we've kicked out expertise, we haven't. Remember, there's a committee, there's a duplication. When it comes to litigation, there's a specific committee that is created in terms of legislation to advise the registrar on litigation issues, on legislation issues. Now, and these people are appointed as per expertise and independent. And for consultation, we have that, and we also consult, as Momo said, industry bodies, so that you get a collective voice from the industry instead of getting voices from individual people, because people were appointed into the advisory committee as individuals based on their own expertise. But we still have the right, the responsibility to call in any expertise from anybody other than the industry bodies. But industry bodies, it's a must. They must be consulted. Thank you.
Of the Pension Funds Act, then we are just proposing
in item 3 in the A bill on page 11, we are just proposing to insert the wording in subsection 1DI of section 37D in the Pension Funds Act. So that's amending section 37D of the Pension Funds Act. So those are the two